So it's now my pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker for this morning, Carol Coletta. Carol is president and CEO of CEOs for Cities and host and producer of the nationally syndicated public radio show Smart City. Previously, she worked as president of Coletta & Company in Memphis. In addition, she served as executive director of the Mayor's Institute on City Design, a partnership of the National Endowment for the Arts, U.S. Conference of Mayors, and the American Architectural Foundation. Having participated in one of those institutes, I can tell you it's an extraordinary program. And if anyone ever invites you to go, you really learn a lot. You hear the mayors interacting with each other, and it's just extraordinary. Carol was a Knight Fellow in Community Building for 2003 at the University of Miami School of Architecture, and is currently a candidate for a Master of Design Methods at the Institute of Design. And she is frequently interviewed as an expert on urban issues by national media and is an active speaker on the success formula for cities and creative communities. This year, she was named one of the world's 50 most important urban experts by a leading European think tank. Please join me in welcoming Carol Coletta.
Thank you, Jeff. Well, welcome to Chicago. Your agenda is so rich and packed. You may not have a chance to see much of it, but if you are able to get out of the hotel, I will tell you that you definitely should see Millennium Park just a few blocks away. And while you're at Millennium Park, you should see what I think really is one of the world's most beautiful urban spaces, the Lurie Garden. It's my favorite. It's filled with purple right now. It's just so gorgeous. So you can go over there and contemplate what you've heard here. And then if you want to experience just a little bit more, you can go another block and go to the Taste of Chicago, where the point of the drill is to eat. I hope you'll get out and get a bit of a chance to experience the place because it is a fabulous city. Jeff talked about, in his opening remarks, this notion of doing housing policy right requires the bridging of silos. And last week I was part of a discussion on innovation in Washington, and DuPont Chairman Chad Holliday and the new CEO of the Smithsonian, Wayne Clough, were asked to name the biggest challenge they face in their organization to innovation. What is the biggest barrier to innovation, they were asked. And they both gave the same answer. People operate in silos, which they both noted is the normal way we operate. We're all specialists now. So as I was thinking about what I might want to say this morning, it occurred to me that I probably know less about housing than anybody in the room. And that gave me momentary writer's block. But then I thought about what Chad and Wayne had said was the key to innovation. And they said that getting people with diverse knowledge talking to one another was fundamental to innovation. So I'm going to consider this my silo-busting opportunity. I'm not going to try to pretend I'm a housing specialist. I'm not. That's what you are, and let me say quickly, I so appreciate the critical, urgent work you are doing in this area of housing to try to catch up to this awful situation we're facing and to see on the other side. I appreciate your work very much. But what I want to do this morning is to try to nest that work that you're doing as housing specialist in sort of this larger framework of what makes cities successful. So first, let's just get the obvious on the table. You know this, I know this. Unless we have successful cities, we cannot and will not conquer the challenges that face our nation, nor can we solve the housing puzzle. So your success in housing is very much dependent on the success of cities, because that's where America works, that's where our productivity is produced and generated. Cities and the metro areas they anchor, you've heard these statistics, generate 80% of our nation's employment, 80+% of our GNP, and produce 86% of our tax revenues. So without strong cities, we simply cannot have a strong America. But right now, nothing feels particularly strong in America, does it? Nothing feels particularly strong. We funded a big stimulus package, and I'm glad we did, but because the emphasis was on do it now, do it fast, we are pretty much going to get more of what we've already got. There was no time to make big policy shifts, big policy changes with the stimulus money. It's funny, the person who was appointed to run the stimulus in New York State calls himself the Czar of Asphalt. But if we climb out of this hole and find ourselves in the same place we were when we fell in, I think we're in trouble. The question is, how do we use this jolt to the system to invent something new, something smarter, something much better suited to the world as it will be versus the world as it was? Now, here's what we know about the world as it will be. The single most important characteristic of successful cities is talent. Our proxy for talent is college attainment, and we know this. We know that the percentage of college graduates in any city's population explains 58% of its success as measured by per capita income. Think about that. 58% of the success of any city as measured by per capita income is foretold by the presence of college graduates in your population. Let me tell you what this means in terms of money. If we could increase college attainment in each of the top 51 metro areas in America, those metro areas with a million or more people, the nation would realize a $124 billion annual dividend in the form of additional personal income. That's not spun, that's not leveraged, that's not turned, that's direct personal income. Now, I joke and say $124 billion used to sound like a lot of money, but when you consider that this is $124 billion annually produced without additional debt that we have to pay off, that's significant money. Talent is a real conundrum for cities because talent-rich ecosystems are not easy to replicate. And to realize their full economic value, talented and ambitious people increasingly need to live where other talented, ambitious people live. So you see the problem. If you start with a lot of talent in your population, you've got this positive reinforcing cycle. Talented people attract talented people. And that's going on in a few places in America, but not a lot. So if you are missing a concentration of talented people in your population, it's very hard to sort of restart the engine to get that turned to a positive. As I say, it is a real challenge for cities that are shrinking, cities that are in decline, even mid-sized cities. How many of you represent mid-sized cities? Mid-sized cities. Okay. All right. The rest of you from large cities? Big cities? Big top, big metros? Okay. Size here matters, and it's easier, frankly, to attract talented people to larger metro areas, but that doesn't that leaves us with a whole lot of cities and metros in the middle, and again, this conundrum of what to do there to, what I would say, amplify, intensify, magnify the presence of talent in those communities. Big talent-attracting places benefit from accelerated rates of urban metabolism. By almost any measure, the larger a city and its talent pool, then the greater the innovation and wealth creation per person. Some very interesting work right now being done at the Santa Fe Institute on this question. And you should catch up with it because it's sort of reverses a lot of what seems intuitive to us about the way cities operate, just in the way that the Center for Neighborhood Technologies work on carbon emissions challenges our conventional wisdom about how we produce carbon emissions, and particularly on a per capita basis, which shows, by the way, that cities, of course, are far less carbon producing on a per cap basis. So talent attracting places are better able to overcome business failures, reabsorb their talented workers, and grow new businesses. And we're beginning to see that while suburbanization and sprawl made sense for a time, the places that thrive today are going to be those with the highest velocity of ideas, the highest density of talented people, and the highest rates of metabolism. So I think, again, the way in which you do your work in housing and where you choose to work will have a lot to say about whether cities are well positioned on this critical issue of talent. We need to think about that. Let me stick with the talent issue for just a few more minutes, because I think, again, there are other interesting intersections with housing and with neighborhood revitalization. First, we know that 25 to 34-year-olds are showing a greater propensity to live within a 3-mile radius of the CBD, the Central Business District, than are other Americans. Let me give you a couple of facts, really interesting. 1980, they were 10% more likely than other Americans to live within a 3-mile radius of the CBD, the close-in neighborhoods. By 1990, that percentage had grown to 12%, but by 2000, that percentage had grown to 33%. 25 to 34-year-olds are now, in 2000, we're 33% more likely than other Americans to live within that, in those close-in neighborhoods. And I don't think anyone doubts that that percentage continues to increase. And by the way, that trend holds in every one of the top 50 metro areas in the country. The point is that 25 to 34-year-olds, who, by the way, are the most mobile people in America, are an important source of revitalization in older neighborhoods. You know, of course, that the greater the access to opportunity in the form of jobs and education that poor people have, the better their chances are of increasing their incomes. Now, that's not to say it necessarily happens naturally. It's not to say you don't have to operate with intent, but even operating with intent, you're better positioned to connect poor people with opportunity if they are living in close proximity to opportunity. So to the extent that young adults move to close-in neighborhoods, bring new money, bring new businesses, that makes good opportunity for everyone. But while the development, attraction, retention of talent is important to the success of cities, is by no means, of course, the only essential. Fostering connections. This notion of connections is the second thing that we've identified that cities have to be really good at doing in a knowledge economy. So where and how you develop housing will be an important factor in whether connections are fostered. So density, mixed-use neighborhoods, walkability, alternative means of transportation are fundamental to what we call the city advantage. It turns out that cities have natural advantages. Cities offer naturally variety, a wide range of valued choices. They naturally offer convenience. In cities, there are more choices close at hand. Discovery is another city advantage. Cities offer people chances to discover things they didn't know they liked, to discover things they didn't know they wanted to know, and people they didn't know they could make things with, including fun and babies. And cities naturally offer more opportunity to their citizens in the form of access to jobs and education and smart people. But here's the problem. We keep screwing it up. We keep undermining the city's natural advantages. Instead of building compact cities that magnify, amplify, intensify these city advantages of variety, convenience, discovery, and opportunity, we've blown it. And we have especially blown it in mid-sized cities. The very cities that need these advantages the most have been those cities that have been allowed to thin out the population over the landscape. We've let our communities sprawl all over the landscape, thereby dissipating these cities, the city's natural advantages. I can't understand what possible sense this makes, especially when at this moment we need all the advantages we can possibly collect. I've been struck, as I'm sure you have, about this recent flap, and just in the last 10 days, 2 weeks, about land banks, which I know you're going to be talking about over the next 3 days, and teardowns in shrinking cities as the terrible return of urban renewal. We had a similar debate at our CEOs for Cities meeting in San Diego last in March, when we had former Bogota Mayor Enrique Peñalosa attacked Kent State's Terry Schwarz's plan for converting Cleveland's vacant land to agriculture as undermining urbanism. Well, I mean, at some level, Mayor Peñalosa was right. To the extent that we allow a place that is not growing to thin out its population, abandon assets by shifting population from one place to another, that undermines the essential dimension of connections and all of the city advantages I've talked about. That's been our history in too many places. But if a metro population is in fact shrinking, then the challenge is different, isn't it? Then the challenge is to find a way to right size, to contract people and contract services in a way that concentrates them rather than spreading them out. So I'm wondering, you know, does clearance become an option for single-use monoculture suburbs? I don't know. It's a question I think we have to ask. Four cars in every garage may once have been the dream of Americans, but it's now clear that not only is that time-consuming and isolating, not only does it undermine those natural advantages of cities, but it's also expensive, as the good work at CNT has shown. Last November, CEOs for Cities calculated, again, go back to those 51 top metro areas, if we could reduce vehicle miles traveled by just 1 mile a day, just 1 mile, it would result in a $29 billion annual dividend to the nation. That's calculated on savings on the cost of cars, the cost of fuel, and the cost of maintenance, $29 billion. Now, you don't get people to drive 1 mile less per day by telling them to sacrifice. Americans are not good at sacrifice. But, so they'll only drive less if it makes sense to do so. And what makes driving less make sense? Two things. One, the price of gas goes up and you have proximity to destinations and alternative means of transportation to get there. And those are things that as housing developers, you can work on. You can't do anything probably about fuel prices except as citizens, and you can support what you choose to support. But you can do something about making housing convenient to multiple destinations and to transit and alternative means of transportation. That's something you can do something about. You can develop and restore housing where transit already exists, where there are multiple destinations nearby, where transit is planned. Now, two other pieces of information that we found, we've produced or are producing in the last 12 months that I think you would find interesting. One is a study we did, it's on our website at ceosforcities.org, called Driven to the Brink. Driven to the Brink looked at, I mean, essentially the platform here is that as the gas price rose, the housing bubble popped. And what this study found, two very interesting things. One, when the core of the metro area, the CBD of the metro area, was strong, housing prices tended to be strong throughout the metro area. That belies that old notion that core cities and the suburbs are at war with one another. They're actually not. Their fates move in lockstep over time, and this study really showed that relationship. The other thing it showed is that housing closer to the core tended to remain strong than as you moved out. So that's one piece of information that you may find interesting. The second is something we're working on right now that just preliminarily we're calling walk value, and we're working with the data from Walk Score. You may know that, walkscore.com. This is very interesting, that shows in every market we've looked at, save two, that the higher the walk score, the higher the housing value, all other things being equal. So in a market, take two comparable properties, compare them, the one with the higher walk score has more value. So as you're thinking about holding value in real estate over time, this becomes really important. There were two places that relationship did not hold. One was in Bakersfield, which was California, where the relationship was neutral. And the other, where there was a negative relationship, was, anybody have an idea? Las Vegas, which sort of proved the point. It occurs to me that if mayors and city councils and planning boards really understood, that they are contributing to their own demise, undermining their own tax base, every time they approve another car-dependent monoculture development, I think we could get their attention. I think if they really understood that, I think we could get their attention for better planning, better decisions, better development. So I've talked about the essential dimensions to cities of talent and connections. There are two more I want to mention just briefly. One is distinctiveness, the other is innovation. Distinctiveness means finding a community's unique characteristics and capabilities and then having the confidence to capitalize on those. And distinctiveness, it's not a slogan, it's not a brand, it's not something you add to. It's really an understanding of where are we distinctive, what is our industry mix, our job classification mix, our consumer or citizens' attitudes, behaviors, and beliefs. And if you understand those things, out of that you can understand where you have distinctive attributes to build on. You build on strength, not on weakness, and that's... And that's completely ignored, frankly. I mean, very, very few cities even understand their distinctiveness. They're always looking to some best practice, some idea, what's the hot, every industry runs in herds, right? I was in banking, herd mentality. There's always a herd mentality, every industry. Everybody's looking to copy everyone else. And some of that copying, most of that copying makes no sense at all. It does at a tactical level. I think what you're doing to put together these practices to say, how do we prevent foreclosure or maintain value over time, that makes a lot of sense. But generally at the strategic level and at the city level, it makes no sense whatsoever. Most cities, if they understood their distinctiveness, which they don't have the confidence to capitalize on it anyway. So this is a real, this is actually a real point of strategic advantage if you understand it and capitalize on it. And then innovation, we know what that means. It means tapping the city, tapping the creative potential of all of its assets, most especially its human capital, and then applying that creativity in a way that turns into added value. So talent, connections, distinctiveness, innovation, we call those the city vitals, and those are the things that we believe cities have to be very, very good at doing to be successful in a knowledge economy. Those are the things that are really needed for strong cities. But we have to recognize, and this is important, that strong cities for the next generation will be different in many ways than the cities we built for the last half century. The American dream, the operative American dream, arguably launched at the 1939 World's Fair 70 years ago at the GM Futurama Pavilion, is badly out of date and it needs replacing. Unfortunately, we don't have yet a coherent, compelling narrative of what the next American dream might include. We typically describe what we need to be doing as a society, where we need to be going as a society in one of two ways. One, we describe it in policy want terms. Well, that excites me and the people in this room, but you know, the rest of the world is trying to get the kids up and get breakfast made and get them off to school. So, you know, they're not interested in policy. And number two, we do an eat your spinach approach, right? You ought to do it this way. Well, again, that's not, people don't respond to that. So the question is, where is this wonderful description of what the new American dream can be? Something that makes us all say, I want that. I want that. That's the way I want to live. And I think this relates, again, you know, we've gone through all these, the nomenclature, even in the housing world. Is it affordable housing? Is it workforce housing? Are they poor people? Oh, no, they're not poor people. They're working families. I mean, it's like finding the nomenclature that people respond to. This is challenging. We know this. But put it in the context of thinking about the next American dream. Think about where the things that you see need to get done fit into this larger picture, and how do we talk about it in a way that's not a wag your finger and not a policy wonk thing? We need policy, don't misunderstand me. But where is the narrative that makes American taxpayers say, I want that, I want to be part of that? So we've been thinking a lot about that at CEOs for Cities. I mean, now, describing the dream and, you know, the changes that cities have to make to deliver the dream is like half the battle, right? Then you have to have the leadership that can actualize this, can turn our cities into next generation cities that can then deliver on that new dream. But we've been thinking about this for a while, and it's interesting. I could tell you a story. I don't have time, but I moderated the RJ Daily Forum recently, a global mayors forum. We had about 35 mayors from around the world, and I'd been thinking about this idea of the new American dream. What is that? How do we define that? And what was so funny is I was sitting on Tuesday moderating this session with these mayors, and in the space of about an hour, the mayors of Kiev, Kuwait City, Medellin, Cartagena, Belgrade, Prague all said essentially the same thing. We know that we can't, as we are newly affluent, we know we need to build cities differently than you did. That makes sense. But our citizens still want what you sold them as the American dream. Our citizens want that because they haven't had it. Help. And I thought, oh my goodness, I thought this was about a new American dream, a next American dream. This actually is about a dream of the good life. This is a globally important question. Because as cities have the opportunity to make themselves in a first generation sense, as Kuwait City does, or remake themselves as we do, then the question is, what are their citizens wanting? What are their citizens saying? What is the picture they have in their minds when they say, I want that? So I think this is an urgent question for us. So I want to ask your help. On September 14th and 15th, we are convening about 50 experts from a variety of disciplines to address these questions. We're going to be announcing the details soon, but in the meantime, I have a request. I want to invite you to send me an email in the next 48 hours, if you have your computers. If not, I know you won't do it once you get home, so I'm asking you to do it while you're here. And I want you to tell me, what would you include in your version of the next American dream, of that new American dream? What changes would you make in your city to ensure that it becomes a next generation city? And how would you enable and encourage the leadership we'll need to make the next, the new dream and the next generation cities realities? The leadership question is hardly trivial. I believe we're undergoing this sea change in our sources of civic leadership. Increasingly, it's without institutional portfolio or title. We're seeing a real shift in how civic leadership is developed. Mostly it's try it, do it, fail fast, learn from failure. We're seeing civic leadership operate without an organizational framework, in campaigns with an expiration date and with the benefit of social media tools. And I think the Obama campaign was just the beginning. So I ask for your thoughts by email. Here's the address, C. Coletta. That's C. Coletta at ceosforcities.org. And I promise I'll compile your answers, post them to our blog. We're on a journey to create cities that people love. And I know you're on that journey too. And at the innovation conversation I mentioned earlier, Chad Holliday told us that DuPont has created this position called opportunity broker to bridge the silos that naturally occur among specialists. So I hope this morning I've managed to lift up some opportunities that you can use to bridge the essential work you do in housing to the larger issues of successful cities. Thanks for letting me be here with you.